From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The principle of the rule of law, however well or poorly managed in practice by lawyers and the courts, is fundamental in American democracy. But what about the function of law in countries with totalitarian governments, like the Soviet Union? One scholar who worked recently at the National Humanities Center is pursuing that question. Harold Berman, a professor of law at Harvard University, is writing Volume 2 of The Western Legal Tradition, a study of the effect of the great political revolutions on the development of national legal systems of the West.
Well, at first it is shocking to realize how little contact we had with the Soviet Union, with Russia even, up until after the Second World War. When I went to college in the late 1930s, there were no courses in Russian history. There were no courses in the Russian language, as far as I remember, at Dartmouth. I never heard anything about Russia. I heard a lot about communism, you know, Marxism, Leninism. There were a lot of communists in the colleges in those days. They were sort of a harmless kind of communist, but they flirted with Marxist ideology or theory. They didn't know anything about Russia. And I knew nothing. I mean, I knew something about Peter the Great. I read Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. I knew there was a man named Stalin who was causing a lot of trouble, but I didn't know anything really in detail. We had no courses. And that was one reason I undertook Russian studies, because none of my professors had ever mentioned Russia. You could study the whole of European history, hardly mentioning Russia. There's kind of a wall of separation between Russia and the West. Russia was a kind of a backwater. Then came our alliance in World War II and the realization, which I had at least, and I think others, that the future depended on some sort of amicable relationship between the Soviet Union and the United States. The future just depended upon our relationship. And so I took a Russian grammar with me into the army. But as I said before, when I came out and studied Soviet law, you couldn't get near. The Soviets had this China wall around them. You couldn't get in. They wouldn't answer letters. And there were very few books coming out in the field of law, partly because they weren't writing much in the field of law. They had undergone a terrible upheaval in their own law system, and they'd been through all kinds of apocalyptic and nihilistic experiences, and their law had suffered terribly. Though they had a tradition of law, starting really very late compared to the West, starting only in the 19th century, the Russian Orthodox Church had never developed legal concepts and legal interests like the Roman Catholic Church in the West. It was an invisible church. It was a more a mystical church, and Russia did not have a professional bar or a professional judiciary or codes of law of any kind until the 19th century. Well, they had certain collections which they called codes, but they had nothing substantial. They did not have a rich tradition of law in the sense that the West did.
Well, who arbitrated issues? It was simply up to the aristocracy, the monarchy?
Well, you had officials who were both administrators and judges who decided problems, cases, but you had some people who played the role of representatives before these officials, but they didn't have law schools. See, the first Russian university was in the 1760s. That's 660 years after the first Western university. It wasn't just a case of backwardness, it was a case of a different culture. And then in the 18th, 19th century, especially from the mid-19th century on, the Russians very quickly and very brilliantly began to adapt this Western legal tradition to their own culture. Then came the Russian Revolution of 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution, which cut that off. And then eventually began to bring it back in. And so today you have a rather flourishing Soviet legal system.
Well, how different is Soviet law from from law as we let's suppose that we have a consensus of ideal law in the mm-hmm. United States, that it works, that it's mm-hmm. good. Mm-hmm. What are the differences?
Well, of course, there are a lot of similarities in the sense that if a person commits a murder or a theft or something like that, you have similar concepts and similar procedures. Actually, their trial procedure is much more like the German and French than like the English or American. They don't have a jury, but they have a judge with two laymen sitting as a three-judge court. Their system of procedure, you have lawyers and you have law schools and you have legal concepts. There are some very substantial differences. In the first place, in the economic sphere, you have a planned economy. Now, that means that almost all your industry virtually is in the hands of state enterprises run by state officials mm-hmm. operating under national economic plans. But they have to make contracts with each other or goods won't move. And so each of these state enterprises typically has a lawyer who helps with the contracting. And there are probably a million or more disputes every year over contracts between state enterprises, which are handled in a special system of courts that handle disputes between state economic enterprises, chiefly contract disputes. You know, the contract is, I mean, there has to be an agreement as to what's going to be shipped and when and so forth, and there are lots of problems, legal problems. Now, when it comes to, so if you take ordinary crimes, ordinary contracts, there's a lot of private property in the Soviet Union. They don't call it that, but it is that. A man owns his house, he inherits it, he pays a 10% inheritance tax. All those rules are not too different from what they are in Western Europe. On the other hand, if it's political, then in the first place, there's a great deal of insecurity. You're not sure the judge is going to decide the case himself. He's going to act on instructions from the secret police if it's a case in which the KGB gets involved. Mm-hmm. And there you have insecurity of law. And also, the KGB doesn't have to instruct judges in political cases. The law itself is very oppressive. You have a law which says that it is a crime punishable up to 7 years of deprivation of freedom for a person to circulate statements which are which undermine the Soviet system, mm-hmm. and indeed, to possess literature which contains such statements is punishable up to 7 years. Well, they don't make any bones about this. They want a society which has a common will and a common ideology. And so there are very great substantial differences with regard to freedom of speech.
A naive question, then. How do the Russian people tolerate this? Why do they put up with it?
It reminds me of Mark Twain's statement that everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it.
It's true.
But the first place, the entire history of Russia is the Russians have never had anything resembling democracy or freedom of speech. The only way you can do something about this that isn't subversive, of course, you can go over to the enemy, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, you can try to overthrow the system. Otherwise, I think the best thing to do is either to join the Communist Party and try to work to improve it.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as you've done that, you're in the system. I mean, then you're in a system which believes in unity. You see, it's a powerful system. They have plenty of debate, but it's all within the limits set by the high party leadership. Millions of letters, I'm now told by my friends, I was over there last August in Moscow, and I have some friends who know about these things. They said millions of letters are now pouring into the party leadership and to the press, and they said many of them are signed, though many of them are anonymous, but millions pour in complaining bitterly about conditions. But these are not people who speak to the foreign press or who speak openly in public about this. It's perfectly all right to complain, and people do. They have a sacred right to complain, which they exercise continually among themselves. But you mustn't ever bring it into a political arena. You mustn't ever complain about the system, but only about the way it's working and how you could improve it. But that's one answer. The other thing, of course, is you could join the church, which is really quite interesting, because the church, you can't. The church is tolerated. and the church is the only organized institution which can speak against the system. Of course, you can only say one thing against the system, which is it can say that we believe in God and the system is atheist. The system is officially atheist. Atheism is taught in the schools and so forth. Well, the church can say, we disagree with that, which is a fundamental principle of Communist Party ideology in the Soviet Union, something really believed in other communist countries. I don't think it's atheism is taken nearly as seriously. But basically, as the head of the Militant League of Atheists said in the early 20s, religion is like a nail. The harder you hit it on the head, the deeper it goes into the wood. And the more they smote it, you see, the more dedicated those people were who clung to it. Mm-hmm. And it just proved impossible to eliminate it in that way. But it's also in some sense a cop-out in the political system. It's very hard to be in the church and to do anything about the political system. You're like Simeon Stylites sitting 30 feet up in the air, you know, on that column. I always kind of admired him. There was nothing you could do to change the Roman Empire. And so he made his protest by leaving this world and sitting up on a column for 30 years. I've forgotten how high it was. I said 30 feet. I've forgotten how many feet up it was, but it was... Of course, he did depend on people to pass food up to him, my wife always says when I tell that story.
Harold Berman, who worked recently as a scholar at the National Humanities Center, is a professor of law at Harvard University. At the center, Professor Berman's project was Volume 2 of The Western Legal Tradition, an examination of the impact of political revolutions upon the legal systems of countries of the West. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center recently sponsored a discussion of the practice of medicine today. Here is an excerpt from that discussion with particular attention to professional ethics among medical practitioners. The speakers are Dr. Thomas Ballantyne, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, William Bennett, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Dr. Chase Peterson, vice president for health sciences at the University of Utah, and Dr. Alan Dyer, a professor of medicine at Duke Medical Center and a scholar at the National Humanities Center.
You, Chase Peterson, and you, Alan Dyer, and you, John Knut, and I, we're very concerned about these problems of ethics and medical ethics in particular, and how we come to judge rightful behavior in various medical situations. And the man that I look upon as an expert and that I learned so much from just a few months ago, Bill Bennett, took a rather casual attitude toward this, saying, well, you know, you guys in essence are stirred up about something that may not be as important as you think it is. Did I get the wrong impression?
No, I don't think so. Fair enough. If you ask me, should more philosophers get stirred up about medical ethics, I would say no. First of all, I think enough are stirred up. Second, I see no reason to think that they are more thoughtful or conscientious than thoughtful and conscientious doctors. Third, there are very serious problems that philosophers ought to be addressing, which they are not addressing. It's a matter of shifting weight. Let me just say, for example, you know, one says, one makes the claim, well, the medical profession is in crisis or an ethical crisis. It's like the joke, you know, do you like your wife? Compared to what? I think medicine's in much better shape than law. If you ask the public, their regard for doctors is still much higher than it is for lawyers. A recent U.S. News and World Report story said that public's disenchantment with law is quite profound, and with lawyers. And here you have a situation where people will talk about their lawyer in a way different from the way we were describing yesterday when they talk about their doctor. They say, too many lawyers are greedy, incompetent, and dishonest. Those are serious ethical charges. These are not matters of dilemma, by the way. Journalism, I think there's a profession with some real ethical problems of very serious consequence, because these are the people who are continuing to write that the whole society is in crisis, and innocent doctors pick up this kind of rhetoric and go around saying it. I don't think it's true. That's very interesting. Academics have issued pamphlet after pamphlet about the problems of ethics in other professions. There's a fairly famous series about ethics in the professions issued by a group of academics in which they talk about ethics in the medical profession, ethics in journalism, ethics in law. There is, interestingly, not in that series, a booklet entitled Ethics in the Academic Profession. Are things so good in the academic profession? Are professors really meeting their responsibilities to students such that we can start by sort of flinging salvos at others and not our own? If we talk about society and its ethical problems, things that trouble me, and I wouldn't necessarily argue these are the most important. These are just things that seem to me to be more compelling of a citizen's interest than the problems of doctors, although maybe in some ways related, are things like when you read that certain classes of our society, the illegitimacy rate is now about 50%. When you find out that a large portion of our adolescents are boozed and drugged, fine to talk about these questions on the outer fringes and these hard choices that one has to make, but unless we attend to sort of fundamental matters, rather than the fascination of what's difficult, we may all be living in a very different kind of society. So I don't know if that's a fair answer to your question, Tom. Some of the issues in philosophy of medicine and bioethics are philosophically and intellectually interesting, stimulating, engaging. Whether they deserve the attention of a large number of people, it depends upon an assessment of their relative importance vis-a-vis other questions.
Chase, the greatest lesson I ever had in medical ethics, I think, was when I was at the Boston City Hospital as a student, and at 6 or 7 o'clock at night saw Bill Castle, a professor, take a sputum specimen from a patient and walk down to the lab himself, streak it out, stain it, and look at it, and make a diagnosis. Now, the technology of medicine would dictate otherwise, that you would send the specimen to the laboratory, you'd wait 24 hours and get a report back. In those 24 hours, the patient could die. And yet nobody would have accused Bill Castle of malpractice had he done that. So I think the common cases and the common issues are that we need, as educators and people involved in medicine, to push good people and good examples together with students as much as we can, and expect that in that ethical apprenticeship process, things will be learned.
Is there a way that MDs, that is to say the people who teach in medical schools, is there a way that they weed out suspect students? Or is that a ridiculous question? Do they even worry about their students from an ethical standpoint?
Morally suspect students
who come in and the doctors look at them and they say, you know, this student might have a problem practicing medicine. Do they get rid of them? What happens to them?
A great deal of attention is paid to that issue in terms of the selection of students for medical school. It's a very complicated and difficult issue in terms of how to identify that student, particularly with some of the laws that make information in letters of recommendation that might prejudice an admissions committee against a student very hard to communicate. But it's certainly something that admissions committees take very, very seriously in terms of trying to identify not only competent and bright students, but morally responsible students, students of integrity.
A recent case about that, didn't we? Controversy in the Boston area about letters of recommendation, suitability in regard to some people. I mean, letters of recommendation, once again, truth-telling. I mean, that the currency has been so cheap, and that, I read the hundreds of letters of recommendation each year for applications here, and most of them, you know, just no point in reading. Little glow pieces which tell you nothing. Seems to me that the whole idea is almost now irrelevant.
I think that is an unethical problem, a problem in unethical behavior. And we've reached the point now, we have, or had 2 or 3 weeks ago, 16 applicants for one position as a neurosurgical resident, and we went over the letters of recommendation. Fortunately, neurosurgery being a reasonably small specialty in numbers, we all knew the individual who wrote the letters of recommendation. And we approached this very cynically, that if George said so-and-so, you knew he was saying, don't take this man, although if you read actually what he said, it would be a letter of high commendation. He's one of the best people we've ever had, and so on and so on. But you'd say, well, now, when George writes that sort of a letter, you better be careful. And then another letter would come about another resident. Well, Dick has given this fellow a rather wishy-washy recommendation. That means that Dick wants to keep him to go on his service. So it all becomes a game, right, that really one should not play. If an individual has the intellectual background to be admitted to medical school, and if that individual has come from a background of ethical behavior within the environment in which he has been raised until the time he goes to medical school, then you really don't have to worry about ethical behavior. Would that be a fair statement?
Your worries are, it's a necessary condition. I mean, it's the most important kind of condition.
But then I have a problem with the fact that our medical students come from such diverse backgrounds, our potential students. I see in my own alma mater, Princeton University, allegations of a behavior and an approach to the student, which I would consider outrageous if true. The question of the honor system, that being challenged, the question of the behavior of the student, one to another, so that I don't know how you can be certain, in as Alan said, in the choice of the individual, that he has had the original instruction about rightful behavior that makes him a good physician. On the other hand, I addressed this issue several months ago in a small article I wrote on integrity. And from interviews that I had, and mind you, it was not a scientific poll, I came to the conclusion, much as you have, that professional integrity is still maintained within the medical profession to a degree that I found surprising as I went about questioning residents, young staff people who chose residence, and so on.
I think the conclusion is right, and the caution is right, too. All our judgments are fallible. Our judgments about people's characters are especially fallible. But the notion that they can't be made or shouldn't be made is, it seems to me, mistaken. We make these kind of judgments all the time. There's a pretty good test that can be applied. The principle can be applied context to context. When I'm asked to recommend one of the fellows for a teaching position, and the test there ought to be, would I want this person in the classroom teaching my children? The doctors on admissions committees or certifying committees or whatever could ask the question, how would they feel about their son or daughter getting in an accident and being treated by this physician? We make judgments like this all the time. The most common way in which we make judgments of character I think, just a commonplace example, when we make judgments about babysitters. People make these kind of judgments daily, all the time, and it's exactly that case I just described. Do you want to leave your children in the care of this person? And people will say yes and no in different cases. They do not deal with the selection of babysitters like they deal with writing letters of recommendation for people. Why? Because there's a tremble factor, there's a bite. That's an ethical problem. That's not a problem in medical ethics. That's a problem in the moral currency.
Bill, you identified large areas in society that were more important than whether or not the medical profession was perfect in its ethics. But at the same time, we are in serious trouble in medicine in or because of the bioethical question. I say it that way because we are going to be obliged to allocate resources. Right. And at the moment, the concern for bioethics is in danger of paralyzing our capacity for making those decisions. Partly because you have mentioned, for the reason you've mentioned, we are fascinated by the peripheral, extreme, difficult questions. And if we can't solve those, we get the impression, we lose our nerve and think we can't solve the common middle ground questions. So if we don't solve it, and if we're paralyzed, we will merrily go on our way, every practitioner doing what he thinks is safe rather than what he thinks he ought to be doing with respect to the expenditure of resources. And the resources for medical care are finite, and we've gone from 5 or 6% of the gross national product up to almost 10 now. This is 10% of our GNP that is not in any way directly productive. And if we don't accept the challenge to allocate resources, we will either bankrupt our country or bankrupt our quality of life by being so preoccupied by treatment at the beginning of life, as Tom was saying, and at the end of life, that we don't have resources left for the middle of life.
Do you think the state ought to make those decisions as done in Great Britain? For example, 2 years ago, or three, 78 or 79, the statistics showed that there were around 16,000 deaths per year of individuals who could have had life prolonged, but there were no kidney machines. The health minister had decided that there would be only so many machines in Great Britain. A criteria were set down as to who would be eligible for application for those machines, and that was that. You just cut it right off. That's the way the state handled it.
How would you answer that question?
Oh, no, I asked you.
Well, I think resources are finite, and I think those decisions have to be made. Let me give you some examples of the price we pay if we can't make decisions. Right now, at the University of Utah, we're preparing to put an artificial heart into somebody. There are people in national medical circles that are frightened to death by the fact that we might be successful. Not that we failed, but we'd be successful, because it would pose a financial dilemma on the country that we're not prepared to deal with. If that heart turns out to be successful and useful, it's applicable in 50,000, 100,000 cases a year. Do we have the resources in this country to provide that for that many people? Now, I would argue we don't have the resources for everything, artificial hearts, artificial kidneys, artificial everything. But if we can't work out an ethical allocation system, then we are in the position of telling Galileo not to look up at the heavens because he might see something that we can't deal with, or he might see something we can't pay for. Namely, if that artificial heart is successful, it poses such a financial dilemma for us that we can't deal with ethically in this country because we're paralyzed, that we better stop the research that would lead to the development of the artificial heart for fear of its consequences.
From the National Humanities Center, this has been an excerpt of a discussion of the practice of medicine today. The speakers were Dr. Thomas Ballantyne, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, William Bennett, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Dr. Chase Peterson, vice president for health sciences at the University of Utah, and Dr. Alan Dyer, a professor of medicine at Duke Medical Center and a scholar at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The Center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to listen for Soundings. This week, the program looks at law and medicine. First, a discussion about the Soviet legal system with Harold Berman, a scholar at the National Humanities Center who teaches at Harvard Law School. Professor Berman is the author of a multi-volume work entitled The Western Legal Tradition. Second, the Center's series on the practice of medicine today, Part 5, featuring three physicians and a philosopher who discuss bioethics and the question of equitable allocation of American medical resources. Please join me this week for Soundings.